This is the ESPNU College Football Podcast. Your host today, Ivan Maisel.
Hello and welcome to the April 6th edition of the ESPNU College Football Podcast. This is Ivan Maisel, senior writer at ESPN.com, live from KTIK in Boise, Idaho. And I am joined live from Pittsburgh, PA by Beano Cook. How are you, Beano?
Excellent, excellent. The Pirates won the opener and now playoff tickets go on sale tomorrow.
Atta baby, I knew you'd come around. You're just a homer, you know. Once they start winning,
playoff tickets go on sale later this week.
Hey, Zach Duke, we're all about Zach Duke.
Oh, yeah.
Don't ask me about it. The only other Pirate name I know, I think, is Roberto Clemente. So let's stop while we're ahead.
Okay.
Beano, a great college basketball game last night, the end to an incredible tournament. And I feel very fortunate to have watched it from here, where I'm doing a story about Boise State, in part because, very simply put, I think you can say that Boise State could be college football's Butler.
Absolutely. Boise State is a better choice in Vegas to win the national title in Notre Dame. Can you believe that?
Really?
Oh, yeah.
No.
And it could happen. Now, everything has to break right. Boise State has to go undefeated. Teams have to lose games. But it can happen. It can happen. I'm not. You're kind of leaning toward Boise State to play for the national title, aren't you?
Well, I think that they've got a great opportunity for a long list of reasons, which I will attempt to at least hit the highlights of now. I mean, first of all, I think the victory, the first Fiesta Bowl victory, Oklahoma, everybody went, oh, isn't that great? You know, sort of a pat on the head type. It was a wonderful moment and a great finish and a great game. But, you know, still there was not a lot put in Boise State's bank in terms of public perception. But I think after winning the second Fiesta Bowl in 4 years, they've got a 14-game winning streak, a 25-game regular season winning streak. Chris Peterson, the head coach, is 49-4 since he took over 4 seasons ago. I think people now regard Boise State as a genuine national contender.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
That's the first piece. That's the first piece. Then you look at the schedule this year. That's a huge piece. They've got an attention-grabbing game right off the bat against Virginia Tech. It's technically a neutral site game, even though it's being played at FedEx Field, which is very close to Virginia and not all that far from Blacksburg. And then 3 weeks after that, they play Oregon State here and on the blue turf at Broncos Stadium. So they've got two marquee games. They're going to, and I've even skipped a very important point that feeds from that perception. They're going to start the season most likely in the top five. So given all that, if they run the table, I think it's very easy to see Boise State returning to the Valley of the Sun to stadium out in Glendale, Arizona, to play for the national championship.
Absolutely. They need help, but they can't lose a game. We know that.
No.
But if they beat Virginia Tech at a so-called neutral site, they're on their way. They have a shot. I agree.
You know, and I didn't, I only did I'm in the middle of my interviews. I'm doing a lot of interviews today. I went to practice yesterday and briefly caught Chris Peterson, the coach, and a couple of the players, with a TV camera for College Football Live on a source for a spring practice, wraparound, as they call it. We're going to hit a lot of campuses on the Wednesday show. And they, you know, to talk to them about that scenario, you know, they just look at you like you've got, you know, two heads. You know, it's April. They're worried about today's practice. You know, eventually they might begin to worry about Virginia Tech, you know, and here I am and we are discussing what's going to happen on January 10th. of 2011. But of course, you know, that's the college football fan. Yeah, that's the college football fan and writer in us. And I think given what Butler did, it's an obvious thing to think about. And I think Butler was very similar to Boise State in the sense that I don't think this was a self-contained achievement from this season. Butler had some street cred from past years, and that's why they the winner of the Horizon League ended up as a fifth seed. It's not solely because of what they did this season. And you know, you can talk RPI all you want, but humans do the seedings, and they now regard Butler differently than they may have 2 or 3 years ago.
It's tougher to do in football, as we know, but you only have to win one postseason game. That's one difference. Yeah, Boise State is a legitimate contender to play for the national title in 2010. Absolutely.
Well, and for a lot of reasons. You know, we're talking about street cred, but they have 20 returning starters from a team that went 14-0. It's sort of interesting, and I got into this a little bit in a column that posted today, will post today, Tuesday, probably by the time this podcast is posted, just in the sense of being in Boise. On the one hand, you're removed, and they worry about whether anybody sees them and notices what they're doing. And you know, that struggle to, again, gain credibility nationally. But on the other hand, you're in Boise, and you don't hear all that national chatter, and you are removed from it. You know, you're a world away, right or wrong, from a lot of that stuff. You know, there's only a couple of papers up here that cover Boise State on a regular basis. And sure, I'm sitting in the ESPN affiliate, so they obviously have cable. Everybody does, and, you know. But it's not. I still think there's a sense of being away from all that talk and that chatter when you're up here in the Treasure Valley. And because of that, I think that might actually play to Boise State's advantage.
Has game day ever been to Boise State for a game?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so.
Either.
But
they might make it. Might make it. That'd be a big thing in Idaho.
Well, you know,
game day. That's another thing that might happen this year. Game day might be there for a game.
Well, it would. You know, hopefully they would be. And Oregon State's probably the biggest home game here this fall. But you know, I don't know who else is playing. I think that game's the last Saturday in September. You know, but I don't know. You know, if you and I start, you know, making the schedule for game day, we will get some interesting email from inside the building. But
yeah, we're not doing that. We're just asking.
Yeah.
We're not making it.
Yeah, we're speculating like
well, game
fans.
Day is supreme. We know that.
Yes, we do. But anyway, it's a fascinating premise, and I don't, you know, people will. We've been hearing it for 3 weeks that what Butler achieved, you know, you can't do in college football, and I would come back and say I'm not sure that where Boise State is right now is all that different from where Butler was when this tournament began. You know, they've got to win some tough games, they've got to win some not so tough games, but if they do that, I think they're going to be in the mix at the end of the year. And if they are, Beano, then a lot of the chatter about the negative chatter about the BCS, especially in Washington, will go away. So, you know, oddly enough, Boise State, you know, they talk about how the for lack of a better term, BCS conferences, the automatic bid conferences, I guess we're supposed to say, are, you know, have an advantage over the Boise States of the world. But I think a Boise State run to the championship game will do nothing but help the automatic bid conferences and everybody else that is invested in the BCS.
And I think the big conferences will then go for a plus one real quickly. I think you...
Yes, well...
Boise State makes it, say, over a team that lost one game in the Big 12, we're going to have a plus one real quickly, in my opinion.
Yeah. Thank you, Boise State. Thank you, Boise State. You made Congress go away. Now, you know, you got to play one more game to win.
Yeah.
Well, it's a great topic, and I'm sure it's one we're going to revisit. But it's certainly topical after last night. Just an incredible basketball game. Did you think Gordon Hayward's shot was going to go in half court?
I was hoping it would, and I'm not anti.
Yeah, I think everybody was.
I think, no. I thought it had a shot. It's unbelievable.
He did.
Yeah.
And
it had a shot.
I don't think you will see a better hit all fall than the screen that Matt Howard set, I think, on Kyle Singler right before Hayward hit that shot. Singler was running down chasing Hayward and didn't see Matt Howard standing there, and he just crumpled to the ground. Of course, he then began celebrating, but still, it was a great hit. But the end of a great tournament. Speaking of which, I wanted to point out, I referred to this on three-point stance last week on the website, but the AFCA, the American Football Coaches Association, released a survey of its FBS head coaches recently, and it said that 93% of the 117 FBS head coaches who responded to the survey, and that's out of 120, I think, so that's a pretty good number, prefer the traditional bowl system over a playoff. 85% are in favor of the current BCS team selection process. 30% of the coaches favor a modifications to the BCS system, and of that 30%, half of them prefer the plus one model that would result in one more BCS game. What do you make of that?
Well, the coaches, it's like Al McGuire said years ago, the only two happy coaches at the end of the year, the coach who wins the NCAA tournament and the coach who wins the NIT. Well, the NIT is really, nobody even knows who's in it any longer. And I think that's one reason. Coaches go to a bowl game and they win, and it's good for them and their contract. I still believe that at most coaches want a plus one. I think that figure's too low. I think I'm surprised that only that many want a plus one. But, the coaches want to play it safe. Get in a bowl game, win it, you know, you're not going to get fired most of the time.
Most of the time. But you made a great point yesterday when we were talking, and it's that the NFL head coaches.
Yeah, the NFL coaches don't like the new overtime necessarily because that's another decision they have to make. They go down there, 4th and 2 on the 11. Do they go for the first down or do they kick the field goal? If they kick the field goal, then Team B scores a touchdown, they get roasted. Coaches don't like to make decisions. The fewer decisions they have to make, the better they like.
But they want to make every decision that affects them. They are control freaks. They just don't want to have to make a lot of decisions.
Oh, that's right.
And the point pertaining to NFL coaches is that whatever they wanted mattered not one bit to the owners when they made that decision.
Yeah, the owners, it is their toy.
Yes, and the commissioners are going to do what they're going to do regardless of what the AFCA thinks or hopes or surveys.
But I think you should look at the survey. You should just not ignore it, but you should look at it. But again, I still think the plus one solves so many problems.
Well, yeah, it's popular. It is a semblance of a playoff, might quell the fervor that has arisen over the BCS and access to the BCS. Last year, there would have been, there would have been a non-AQ team in the four team setup, and you know, it's it makes sense in a lot of reasons, and I'm surprised they don't do it, if only to sort of lessen the drumbeat of change that's out there. But I think the commissioners are getting, you know, somehow we've ended to back up talking about the BCS. I think the commissioners are getting hammered from a PR standpoint. That's why they hired Ari Fleischer, the former Bush 43 press secretary.
Which really is unbelievable. It's unbelievable they hire him. I just don't understand it. It's all beyond me. Why him?
I'm not sure him or what him or anyone else can do to help them make their case. They are.
But if you're going to hire somebody, why? Why him?
What?
He is funny, and he's clever, but I don't understand why you would hire him.
I don't know why they chose him either. I assume because they figure they may need help in Washington, or since they're getting beaten up in Washington, or maybe at least he will know how to negotiate his way around Washington.
Yeah, that's probably the only reason. I don't know if that's necessarily a good characteristic or not.
Well, if you're having problems in Washington, then you know, that's what you do. Someone having problems in Gainesville, Bino, Urban Meyer, chewing out a reporter for accurately quoting a player, which is certainly an unusual stance to take. But I don't think Urban Meyer came out looking too good at the end of this.
Yeah, I can't believe what he did. And you and I are both Urban Meyer fans. We're glad he's staying. But Urban, believe me, I mean, the reporter did his job. The player was not misquoted. I mean, it's a good story.
No.
It's a good quote.
No, it was Deontay Thompson comparing John Brantley, the new quarterback, to Tim Tebow, the old quarterback. And of course, everyone at Florida a little sensitive about Tim Tebow and whatever deficiencies the NFL scouts are seeing in him as we head toward the NFL draft. And Thompson was attempting to say that Brantley was a real quarterback in the sense that he was a traditional drop-back passer. And he was comparing the way the two guys throw.
Yeah, Tebow was a struggling tailback. That's what he was, playing quarterback. The old single-wing tailback of, like, Doak Walker and Johnny Majors, and single-wing is something nobody, any of our viewers probably never heard of, but that's what he was. And he was a great college player. And to the Florida fans, don't worry what the pro scouts think. They can't take away from what he did as a college player. And I don't think...
Absolutely.
I don't think the quotes hurt Tebow. He's just saying it's going to be a different type of offense. That is what he's saying.
No, the only guy who comes out hurt on this, other than maybe the hurt feelings of the Orlando Sentinel reporter, briefly, was Urban Meyer. He completely overreacted, and it brings back into question, you know, how ready he is to get back into the fray. And that's the thing. It's why I went down there last month. It's what we all want to see is how well he can handle the day to day crush of a pressurized job.
I mean, Urban,
said
relax, relax. You're in Florida. You're going to win games, but you're not going to win them all. You're going to have a very difficult time winning at Alabama. But still, relax. It's tough. You have two national titles. Relax. Enjoy it. You're in your 40s. Before you know it, you're going to be 60. Enjoy it. It's tough. But you make a lot of money. You get paid. The pressure's tough. But I know it's easy to say enjoy it. But relax. You're a legend. Enjoy it. And the media.
You know, and the point.
The media, they come out every day. You don't come out at all. You can't win, Urban.
Yeah, that's true. You're not going to win that kind of argument with the media. And the other thing I wanted to point out, though, Bino, since you went ahead and called Tebow a single-wing quarterback, is...
Single-wing tailback.
Single-wing tailback, excuse me. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Is that Meyer has said in the last couple of days that he wants to use two quarterbacks next fall, in the sense that because John Brantley, the heir apparent to Tebow, is more of a drop back guy, Meyer does not want to give up that single wing aspect of his offense. And so he is going to use one of the younger guys to run the Wildcat, or whatever they're calling it, in Florida. And what I find fascinating about that is that you've got a very similar situation at Texas, where you have a running quarterback and Colt McCoy being replaced by more of a traditional quarterback in Garrett Gilbert. And Texas is, not that Texas ever really did a lot of single wing with McCoy there, but Texas is reverting to taking snaps under center, using two backs, using a lot of play action. So Texas, to me, is doing more adjusting to what they have, and Meyer is sticking more to what he likes to do. And it's just an interesting way of two teams handling a similar issue and two coaches handling a similar issue in very different ways.
Well, it will be interesting to see what happens in Gainesville this fall. I just hope Urban Meyer is still coaching 10 years from now. But this concerns me, this blow-up. He's too smart to make a mistake like that. I just don't understand it.
Didn't want to let the show, this ESPNU college football podcast, go by, Beano, without just saying how what an awful story at Notre Dame with the death of the signee, Matt James.
Boy.
In Panama City. He fell off of a hotel balcony. And
boy, that's...
while down there on spring break, and he's from Cincinnati, where Brian Kelly, the new coach, has been for a few years. He's an offensive line recruit, highly thought of, supposed to be a really good kid, and just it's just bad. It's just a bad situation.
Yeah, it's sad. It's needless to say, it's really tough on the parents. It really is sad. It really is.
Well, and Brian Kelly, of course, last week lashing out at the players in spring practice. They're getting away underway in South Bend, the first spring practice under Brian Kelly, saying the offense in particular was completely at a loss, and he read them the Riot Act. So anyway, it's just a bad story, and our sympathy goes to the James family in Cincinnati, and of course to everybody in Notre Dame who'd gotten to know they expected to be a great addition to the Notre Dame program. You know, want to get to the mailbag if we can here. We have a letter from Courtney West, a Texas Tech fan, saying my compliments to you both for producing such an enjoyable podcast. I eagerly await new shows and the insight it provides to the national college picture. Since relocating to the West Coast from Texas, I have found that local sports radio lacks quality discussions on the national college football picture, but thanks to your podcast, I no longer have a problem. I'd like to hear your opinion about Texas Tech in the coming season under the new leadership of Tommy Tuberville, and what Tech fans should expect over the next 3 years.
You're the expert at Tuberville.
Well, I do know Tommy, and I think he's a very good defensive coach. He's a very good head coach. Texas Tech could use some help on defense. I found it interesting that he began spring football with two senior quarterbacks fighting to win the job, and before it ended, both Stephen Sheffield and Taylor Potts, the two seniors in question, had injuries that required surgery. Both will be ready for the fall. So in the meantime, Tuberville gets to have his younger quarterbacks work with the first team for the last few sessions of spring practice. Not that you want anybody to get hurt, and not that you want, I'm sure you'd rather have your starter in 2010 work with the rest of your starting lineup, but it's almost it's not that bad of an outcome for Texas Tech. And I think the fact that he's got several quarterbacks is promising, and if he can just come up with a little bit more defense, then Texas Tech will continue to nip at the heels of Texas and Oklahoma and the Big 12 South, and maybe even catch up to them.
Yeah, be tough, but you're right. They will have Saturdays when they beat those teams. Over a 20-year period, they're going to lose more than they win against Texas and Oklahoma, but they will have their moments of glory. And they did hire a good coach. You've been high on him as long as I've known you as a coach. And that's something for a guy who died with Alabama.
Well, I respect Tommy. I think he handles people well. And I think that just the fact that he was able to beat Alabama 6 in a row, which is very difficult to do for any Auburn coach, is a tribute to what he was able to accomplish. Let's get another question. Brandon, I'm going to butcher your last name, Busquet, I think. Speak of the devil. I was wondering if you and Beano could talk about Alabama's schedule conflict this next season. As it stands now, Alabama's last 6 opponents will come off bye weeks before they play the Crimson Tide: South Carolina, Ole Miss, Tennessee, LSU, Mississippi State, and Auburn.
Well, that really is something, isn't it?
And Brandon is in Wichita, Kansas. I know the SEC is looking at this and trying to figure out if they can do something about it. The fact that they did not notice this until after they released, I'm not sure they've officially released a schedule yet, because they're still trying to figure out what to do.
I bet there's a certain coach in Tuscaloosa who was very upset over this.
I would think that is true. And I have heard that Mal Moore is sort of the athletic director at Alabama has just sort of accepted it, that there's nothing that can be done. But the SEC is still looking at the schedule. The problem, of course, is that if you pull one thread, then pretty soon the whole thing comes unraveled. You know, you can't just move one game. And you know, then you're getting into non-conference schedules, and it could be a bigger problem. Here's an email, Beano, from James Schmitz. I'm a loyal listener to your podcast with Beano. I wish they were more often than every 2 weeks in the off season, but so be it. I have two questions for you and Beano to ponder. With Derek Dooley taking the reins at Tennessee and Skip Holtz now at South Florida, I was wondering if there have been many successful sons of Hall of Fame coaches in the past, and how have they fared?
That's a good question.
Hearing Beano talk about how Joe Paterno left his plans of law school to coach football, I thought of Dooley and Terry Bowden, who are both trained lawyers, and historically have there been other connections to the law profession and the coaching profession? So that's Jim Schmitz in Nashville. I can't think of sons off the top of my head. Obviously, Amos Alonzo Stagg's son coached with him late in his career, and there was always some question about whether the elder Stagg deserved some of those later victories, whether he had been the head coach in name only. The NCAA determined that the victories did belong to Stagg Sr. But I would love to hear from anybody, and I will attempt to do a little bit more research on this, because I nobody rang a bell with me.
No.
To me, it's almost interesting how many sons of famous coaches did not go into coaching.
They saw what it was like on Sunday morning after a loss.
Exactly.
I mean, that's a great question. There has to be. Well, I guess I just can't think of any. I mean, if there were some super coach who had a son who did well, I think one of us would think who it was.
Yeah, we'd know off the top of our heads, I would think. And, you know, I think it's interesting, you know, Pat Dye Jr., for instance, is Pat Dye, senior Hall of Fame coach. Pat Dye Jr. is a prominent agent. So he's sort of in the business, but he's not a coach. But I you're right. I don't, and the Bowden brothers are the most prominent sons of coaches, and Skip Holtz and Derek Dooley not far behind. So if we run across anyone, we will let you know, Jim, but thanks for that question. And lawyers and coaches, I know in the past that, I'll have to go back and look through the history books to see if I can find anybody else. I think in the old days when coaches were more classically educated and thought about going into other professions, I think there were some lawyers, but I can't think of in the modern day, there's not a very many at all, because coaching has become a quote unquote profession in its own right. On the birthday calendar, Beano, today, April 6th, the 1964 Heisman Trophy winner, John Hewitt, at Notre Dame, and one of the more unlikely Heisman winners, was he not?
Absolutely. You know, they were 2-7 the year before, and when the spring practice started with Eric Bosigan, he did say after some early practices that he thought John Hewitt would be the quarterback, but nobody had any idea. Somebody who came out of nowhere to win it. I mean, there have been players who won it their senior year, but they played a lot in their junior year in most cases, and he did not play that much. And, that was a surprise. Most people, a lot of people think Joe Namath should have won it, that year, but Hewitt won it. He was on the
cover of
Sports Illustrated, Dan Jenkins' story, I think Hewitt was on the cover of the title of the story, Notre Dame Returns to Power. And that was some story, Hewitt, definitely. But a lot of people think it should have been Namath.
Well, Namath got hurt late in the year. I think that
hurt him a little bit.
First of his knee injuries.
Yeah.
April 7th, Beano, tomorrow, another guy you know a little bit about, the 1976 Heisman Trophy winner, Tony Dorsett, or as you may have known him at Pittsburgh, Tony Dorsett.
Tony Dorsett from Hopewell, which is right near Aliquippa. So that Beaver Valley produced some good players for a lot of schools. And when Tony came to Pitt, he was 158 pounds. And the people from Hopewell, they were asked, some Pitt fans, well, will he play defense or offense? That's how good he was on defense in high school. And, of course, he played offense, and his opening game was against Georgia. Pitt was a 3-touchdown underdog at Athens and finished 7-7. I forget whether he gained 100 yards or not, but he came close to it. And his last college game was against Georgia, and it won Pitt the national title in the Sugar Bowl. So Dorsett, revived Pitt football. Johnny Majors, who recruited Dorsett, saved Pitt football because there was a feeling in the administration, this isn't worth it, and they were going to give it one more try. And if it didn't work out, they were going to drop it. Same thing at Miami when Saban left. There was a feeling to drop it. They said, let's give it one more try, and both
That's
teams
loose,
gave it
Saban,
one more try. Miami won a lot more national titles than Pitt, but Pitt won a national title within a couple of years, 1976.
That's right, and of course, when he was in college, he was Dorsett. It was not until he went to the NFL that he became Dorsett.
He had great games against Notre Dame. That's what really put him into the limelight. In his junior year, he gained 303 yards rushing against Notre Dame. And then the opening game of the year, of the next year, was ABC. They were supposed to play in October. ABC got Pitt and Notre Dame to agree to open up the season. And, Pitt, a 5-point underdog, pulled the upset. And on that same day at night, Missouri beat USC. And if that not have,
wow.
if USC hadn't lost that game, USC would have gotten the national title over Pitt.
Wasn't that John Robinson's first game? I think that was John in 76. That was his first game.
I think you're right. That was his first game. Yeah. He probably got hung in effigy by Wednesday. Yeah. That was his first game. It's the only game they lost. They came back and they were a 6-point underdog to Michigan in the Rose Bowl, and they beat him 14-6 after trailing 6-0. And Bo Schembechler said before the game, the winner of this game should win the national title. Michigan had lost to Purdue 16-14. And that was the week Pitt went to number one after Michigan lost. But Pitt beat Georgia, and Pitt was the unanimous choice to win the national, won the national title. Yes, what a history for you.
That's great. That's why we're here. And this has been, well, wait a minute. Before
it's
I say
April,
that.
It's not April Fool's. We're 5 days late, but we're still fooling everybody. We're still fooling everybody. And we will be back 2 weeks from today, which is
that's right, April 20th. That's right. And we will catch Beano live from the center field bleachers at PNC Park, I think, on the 20th, right?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
This has been the ESPNU College Football Podcast. For Beano Maisel, this is Ivan Beano Maisel. Let me get out of here. I think I'm done. For Beano Cook, this is Ivan Maisel. Thanks for downloading us.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's show. For more great podcasts, check out the Pod Center page at ESPNradio.com.